Sirs, moms, ladies and gents, welcome back to the Redcoat History Podcast with me, Chris Parkinson. Today we're looking once more at the British Redcoats of the American Revolution. Often mocked, undervalued or portrayed as red-coated imperial stormtroopers with a hatred of those freedom-loving American rebels. In the last episode, we looked at who they really were, their backgrounds, places of birth, and how much training they received. Well, today we're joined once more by author Robbie McNiven, who was great in that last episode, to find out more about the 33rd Regiment of Foot during the Revolution, their battles, how they performed, and why ultimately the Americans won the war. The 33rd were arguably Britain's most elite regiments of the era, not including the Foot Guards, of course, and they fought in almost every major battle of the Revolution. Robbie's written a book about them called The Pattern, and I've put a link to it in the description below. But for now, guys, let's get stuck in with Robbie giving us a fascinating overview of the regiment's experience in America.
So the 33rd missed the very start of the Revolutionary War. They just won in North America at Lexington and Concord, and they missed Bunker Hill. Cornwallis is with the regiment in the UK, and he's quite eager to get over to North America because he's he's a professional soldier. He knows that's where the action is unfolding, and that's where he wants to be. So he manages to make sure that he is given command of a reinforcement detachment that's sent out from Ireland in right at the start of 1776. So the 33rd arrives in time to basically fight the rest of the war, which they're heavily involved in. They're at every major action and a lot of little actions as well. They're part of a reinforcement contingent that's deployed, and their first engagement is actually in the south at Charleston. They're part of the debacle of trying to capture Sullivan's Island, but they aren't really heavily engaged in that action. And then they move north with the army, and their first major fight is at Long Island, which is one of the biggest battles of the war. So that's showing the whole New York campaign, and it kind of starts at Long Island and then it carries on for the next 2 months, going through New York City and then north, and then eventually driving the Continental forces off through New Jersey and into Pennsylvania. But the 33rd are chosen at the start of that campaign for special privileges, probably because Cornwallis has managed to bring them up to such a high standard during the pre-war years and during their training. So they're deployed with the Army's vanguard, which contains really the best units. So the composite light infantry and grenadier battalions, which I mentioned previously, they form the vanguards of the Army. They're going to be the first ones engaged. And the 33rd and the 42nd Foot, so the what becomes the Black Watch, the Royal Highland Regiment, they are also put into the vanguard as kind of a backup. So they're going to be going in first. And they do that at Long Island. The army is very adverse to the concept of attacking continental held defenses head on. So they perform a very wide flanking maneuver to the east and sort of catch the Continentals off guard, swing round and roll up their line and drive them back. And the 33rd are involved in this right at the forefront of the action. They
is this
push
Throng's Neck?
So that's the campaign image. Sorry, I don't know if I have a battle image. So the battle itself is at the bottom. I'm trying to look at the numbers. 1, 2, and 3. That's the actual Battle of Long Island.
Right,
beneath New York City. They swing round and they drive in the Continental flank, and they pursue Continental forces to their defences in Brooklyn Heights, which is where they've got a second line of defences, and they want to attack that as well, but the senior commanders ride up quickly and say, don't attack that because we've probably overextended and it could turn victory into defeat, and they have to be restrained a little bit. So it's a promising first major battle for the regiment, and it kind of sets the tone not only for the regiment, but how the army fights as a whole, trying to outmaneuver enemy forces, basically.
Yeah, so we've got this map on screen from your book, which shows all of the major engagements. So they've been down at Charleston. They've now just fought at Long Island and around New York. What was next for the 33rd?
So after that, the army is kind of secures New York and its major base of operations for the rest of the war, really. And the primary objective is to trap and destroy the Continental Army and George Washington, which George Washington knows, and he's extremely good at maintaining pressure on the Crown forces while avoiding being drawn into one major engagement where he might be sort of overwhelmed. So that is basically the tone of the rest of the war, really, is trying to force major destructive battles on the Continental Army. And to be fair, there are still a lot of pitched engagements which the 33rd are involved in. So after New York, they spend some time in New York itself or the environs. The plan for the next year is to capture Philadelphia, which is the capital of the Continental Congress. And so they are involved in the successful capture of that city. There's another major battle at Brandywine, which has very similar tactical choices to the ones undertaken at Long Island. So a diversionary force is used to pin the Continentals into what they think is going to be the main offensive. And then a large flanking maneuver is made around the right flank of the Continental Army. Again, the 33rd are involved in this flanking maneuver. And they kind of crash into the Continentals just as they're redeploying to try and face this new threat. They realize what's happening in time, just about, but they're kind of too late. And again, they're broken by the offensive. The 33rd aren't right in the front line of this, the way they were at Long Island, but they are called up towards the end, just as there are the rear guard of the Continentals is making its last stand. So they engage them and drive them off. And that kind of marks the end
Is
of that engagement.
that them just at tea under Dilworth? Is that them?
Yes, that is correct. So the little village of Dilworth is kind of close to where the last rear guard of the Continentals is, and they clash with them just as it's getting dark, and then the nighttime kind of cuts off any further action, any further pursuit. So after that, the Continentals withdraw and abandon Philadelphia, and the British occupy Philadelphia. And much to their shock, that doesn't signal the end of the war because the centre of power isn't really located in the capital city the way it is in Western Europe. The rebellion is happening all over the colonies at this point. So capturing Philadelphia is a blow towards the revolutionary cause, but it doesn't signal the end of the fighting. So having realized that Philadelphia holding it doesn't actually render much strategic advantage, the British abandon the city the next year and the army pulls back to New York. And that's when the next major battle occurs for the 33rd. They kind of have to do the opposite of what they did at Brandywine. They are actually part of the rear guard in this case. So the army is withdrawing overland, trying to get to Sandy Hook to then catch a boat to New York, which they are already occupying, and the Continentals engagement at Monmouth. And it's a very hard-fought battle in extreme temperatures. I think there's about 50 or 60 dead from both sides just from heat stroke. And the 33rd aren't involved in most of the fighting, but towards the end of it, as the British are performing a fighting withdrawal, they come up. It's unclear if they're actually ordered to advance or if they do it on their own initiative. But they come up and they rescue basically the last regiment out of the area, one of the Grenadier battalions. They intercede and drive off the Continental troops briefly and give them enough time to withdraw. And then the army is able to safely evacuate to New York. After that, it's 1779, and that's a fairly quiet year in terms of overall campaigns. Both armies are. Their centre of power is around New York, and the British know that if they leave it, they can't really force Washington to engage, and Washington knows he's not strong enough to just attack New York. The 33rd are, however, very nearly destroyed in a freak incident. They are garrisoning one of two small forts on the Hudson River, just north of New York. And there's a fort on either side of the river, one on the east bank, one on the west. They're garrisoning the one on the east. And Washington identifies these two forts as they're sort of a bit isolated and they're outposts essentially. And they can't be easily supported by the rest of the army. So he mounts a daring assault on both forts. The one on the river on the west side is successful, and the troops there, mostly I think it's the 17th Regiment, are captured. It's a bit of a disaster. Not the whole regiment, but a good chunk of the regiment and a few other detachments are taken prisoner. The attack on the east bank fortuitously fails. The 33rd are kind of, they catch wind that the fort on the west bank is under attack, and they stand to with great alacrity, and the small number of cannons in the fort are well handled. So they are able to, the fort doesn't actually then come under assault. The attack force, the attacking continental force, kind of moves up and sees that the defenders are kind of ready, which wasn't the case with the west bank fortress. So they kind of stick around for a couple of days, but by this point, reinforcements are coming up from New York, so they abandon it, and the 33rd aren't rescued, which could have been a very different end to their war if they'd all been taken prisoner a couple of years prior to Yorktown.
Does that engagement have a name, Robbie, if I was to look it up and look at the pictures?
So the capture of the fort on the West Bank is Stony Point, and that's kind of a big deal for the Continentals because that's a rare case of them going on the offensive and storming a sort of a well-held British position. And then the East Bank is the fort is called Verplanks. It was originally a Dutch crossing point in the river. But I don't really think there's probably not many images of Verplanks because the whole thing is famous because it's Stony Point is the one that was captured, and kind of nothing technically happens at Verplanks apart from it isn't captured. So, but yeah, there's definitely images of Stony Point.
Great.
So yeah, 1779, the regiment basically manages to avoid destruction. 1780, the British decide to shift focus south to the Carolinas. There's a belief that North and South Carolina have a large loyalist population who will rise up and support British troops once they return. There are more loyalists in the Carolinas than there are elsewhere, but there aren't actually enough willing to do fighting, it emerges, once the army gets there. So that campaign fails, but it's also where the 33rd kind of win their biggest laurels of the war. So Cornwallis himself is in command of that southern campaign. He has command of the entire army there. And the 33rd play a prominent role in major events, particularly the two largest battles at Camden and Guildford Courthouse. So Camden is...
There it is.
Yes. Camden is the, by some to be the greatest British victory of the war, certainly the most complete one. In some ways, it's kind of uninspiring in terms of tactics, because all Cornwallis does is just launch a frontal assault and relies on the superiority of the British line regiments to just drive off the Americans, which is what they do. But the 33rd and the regiment they brigaded with, the 23rd, who are also considered to be a very good regiment, they are responsible for caving in the left flank of the Continental forces. It's actually mostly militia on the left flank, who normally aren't particularly steady troops when it comes to linear warfare. So the militia break in front of the 23rd and the 33rd, who then wheel round and engage the Continentals on the right flank, their left flank. And it's extremely fierce fighting for about half an hour, but eventually the Continentals give way as well. And it's a complete rout. The American army is just basically destroyed. The American general, General Gates, is one of the first people to run away and turns up miles and miles away reporting his own defeat. And yes, the 33rd are hailed as having played the most vital role in winning that. The Battle of Guildford Courthouse, which happens about 7-8 months later, March 1781, and that is an extremely hard-fought and bloody battle. It's famous as being a kind of Pyrrhic victory in so much as the British drive off the Continental forces but suffer more casualties in the process. So at that engagement, the Continental commander, General Greene, his idea is to basically force the British to assault three separate lines, knowing that the first line they'll probably break through, but then they'll be pretty tired and disorganized by the time they reach the second line. And if they manage to break through that, then they'll be really exhausted and broken up by the time they reach the third line. And his idea is that, you know, the third line will then win him the battle. And the British, as they did at Camden, they kind of just go straight in. The 33rd are on the extreme left flank, so they have difficulties in so much as they're having to attack the troops directly in front of them, but because the continental line is longer, it overlaps, so they're also having to stave off flanking attacks on the left and maintain the coherency of the overall line. And this is all happening in forested terrain, so they're having to employ light infantry tactics, which they were very conversant in by this point in time. But they do it. The army as a whole manages it. They break the first line, they carry on into the second line, they break the second line, and then they carry on into the third line. The 33rd are actually the first unit to make contact with the third line. Things have become very disjointed in the forest and in the woodlands. So the 33rd emerge. The third line is actually on a small hill beyond the forest. So the 33rd emerge from the forest first. They're the first unit to make the breakthrough. And they, rather than wait for any other units to come up, they push ahead straight away and attack the third line and are extremely punished for this aggression, because the third line is, the Continentals there by this point in the war are quite experienced themselves, and they're, you know, in a good defensive position. They drive back the 33rd. This is one of the only times that the regiment is bested in open combat and forced to retreat. They pull back to the edge of the forest where they rally and kind of engage in some long-range, long-distance shooting. Unfortunately, the commander of the 33rd in the field, so Cornwallis is the overall colonel, but in the field they're led by their Lieutenant Colonel Webster, a fellow Edinburgh Scot, who is extremely well thought of and had brigade commands and was seen as extremely competent, but his luck runs out here. He's shot in the knee and he doesn't die immediately, but he perishes of his wounds a few days later. So the 33rd are driven back at this point, but they do rally, and then the rest of the army makes it through the woodlands and commences its attack on the 3rd Continental Line. And after much bloodshed and struggle, the Continentals do withdraw, leaving the British master of the fields and the master of a lot of dead bodies.
Okay, and so this was still down in the Carolinas, was it? And then we yes. moved back up north.
Yeah, well, yes. So this is North Carolina, and then after that, Cornwallis decides to shift focus to Virginia, so a bit further north, and he throws himself into Virginia, where the army sort of moves back and forth the countryside, freeing slaves and burning plantations and things like that. Kind of unclear at this point what Cornwallis is doing, because there's a strategic concept. The British High Command is very disjointed and there's no real clear view. It's clear that the idea that there's going to be a big loyalist uprising in the south has kind of been over exaggerated, and that isn't going to happen. But Cornwallis isn't withdrawn from the south. He kind of just carries on. So he ravages Virginia, essentially, and then he sets up base at Yorktown, which initially seems like a very good idea because it's a port, it's a coastal area, which means he has easy access to the sea, which means he has easy access to the Royal Navy, which normally are the vital link which keeps the army supplied in times of duress. He knows that if Yorktown is besieged, worst case scenario, then he can't hold out. He can simply evacuate via the Royal Navy and they can return to New York. And then the French arrive, and that changes everything, because the French have a navy, unlike the rebel Americans. And the arrival of a French fleet outside Yorktown was not what the British were expecting. The Royal Navy tries to break through the French blockade and fails. Washington realizes that he's got this opportunity to defeat an army, a British army. So he leaves where he's encamped outside New York, takes his army south, lays siege to Yorktown. So at this point, it's being attacked by the French Navy and on the coast, and the Continentals have it bottled up inland. There's fairly poor communication between Cornwallis and the British Commander-in-Chief with the main British Army in New York, Sir Henry Clinton, who doesn't really seem to appreciate the severity of the situation. There's also some bad beef between Clinton and Cornwallis, which maybe causes him to react a bit more slowly than he should have done. So by the time Clinton gets ready to head south and try and relieve Cornwallis, it's kind of all over. The Continentals have a lot of artillery. They're bombarding Yorktown constantly. Food's running out. There's disease. The Continentals capture some of the outer positions of the fortifications defending Yorktown. And basically the Crown forces are left with no choice other than to surrender, which is the probably the second biggest defeat the British suffer during the war after Saratoga, which was an earlier defeat up north along the Hudson River in 1777. So in 1781, at Yorktown, Cornwallis surrenders to 33rd with the army that surrenders. They've been whittled down by a year and a half of extremely hard campaigning. I think there's only a couple of hundred of them left at this point. And yes, the scene that plays out in a million documentaries and textbooks and stuff is the British forces march out, lay down their arms, and are marched into captivity. And in a lot of popular history, that's where the war ends. But in reality, that's mistaken, because it carries on for two more years. There are some pretty major engagements and battles outside of North America that have a very important bearing on how the war ends for Britain, if not for the Americans. So clearly the Americans have secured their independence at this point. But things like the Great Siege of Gibraltar are still ongoing. The Battle of the Saints, which is a major naval victory for Britain in the Caribbean, which kind of ensures that they keep hold of things like Jamaica. That's very important from a British perspective, but it doesn't really matter to the Americans, so it's not studied as much. Anyway, I'm digressing.
No, I think that's brilliant, Robbie. And I mean, for me, I'm a complete novice when it comes to the American Revolution. So that for me was just a great overview that covers a lot of the main battles and tells us about the 33rd. So with this surrender then, what happens to the 33rd next? Like what happens to them as a regiment?
Yeah, so I think that's one of the things I was most interested in when I was doing the research. The history, the campaign history is quite well covered, just because it's, you know, it's the popular stuff, it's the battles. But researching the pre-war history, the training and stuff like that was interesting. And also the post-Yorktown history of what became of the 33rd, which I didn't really know anything of. So most of the soldiers are marched off to captivity, and they spend about a year, year and a half in a big American prison camp. I can't remember exactly where it is. It might be Maryland, Pennsylvania. They moved around a bit. The conditions aren't great, but they're not as bad as some infamous prison camps like, say, Andersonville in the American Civil War. And yeah, they're kind of just kept. It's not sort of like everyone's shoved in the room and the door's locked. They are free to move about to an extent and live within a certain locale, a certain area. And a lot of them either, well, not a lot, but a reasonable percentage, escape and head back and rejoin the army, or escape and desert and just live in America. A few of them, including the guy who I mentioned at the start, the enlisted man, John Robert Shaw, actually desert and join the Continentals and are encouraged to do so by, you know, bounty and promise of land and things like that. But most of them, though, they just remain in captivity. But the regiment isn't entirely captive, because not all of it was present at Yorktown. So as I mentioned, the flank companies, the Grenadiers and Light Infantry, are detached, so they aren't present with the army that basically gets captured in full at Yorktown. I think there's a lot of people as wounded, deserters, stragglers, people who just weren't with the regiment at the time. They were maybe convalescing elsewhere. They're kind of brought together along with, I think it's just the Grenadier Company, and they're kind of reconstituted as a very small fragment in Charleston in South Carolina, which at that point, even after Yorktown, is still under British control. And one of the officers, the former light infantry captain, who at this point is a major in the regiment, William Danzy, who writes a load of really fascinating letters, he is sort of given charge of making sure that the regiment isn't just wiped out. And there's a lot of stuff in his letters about his struggles to maintain things like discipline and make sure that the men are clothed and paid, and that they are still a fighting force, that they're still capable, even though there's only a very small number. I'm not sure, it's probably about less than 100 men, certainly. But they still exist to an extent as a regiment. They still had the regimental colours, which weren't taken to Yorktown. They were left in Charleston. And they actually see action after Yorktown. There's no major pitched battles that they're involved in, but there's some skirmishes, Continental troops trying to kind of pressure Charleston and move into the area around about it. They kind of drive them off. And then Charleston is evacuated and they move north and they move back to New York. And they're actually involved in one of the last, you can't really call it offensive, but outwards British maneuvers of the war. They're sent into the countryside with a larger detachment, I think on Long Island, kind of just forage. And the revolutionary forces are present, but everyone kind of knows that the war, this is, it's literally, I think, a month until the official peace treaty is signed, and everyone knows that the war is pretty much over. So there's no fighting, they don't shoot at each other, but the officer, Danzy, makes the claim that the 33rd were involved in the very last British operation of the war. After that, the peace treaty is signed, the regiment is moved out of New York, they go to Halifax in Nova Scotia, which is an important British garrison, and they're brought back up to full strength with recruits and also with the prisoners who've been released from the Yorktown surrender. And then eventually, after a few years, they go back to the UK and resume sort of standard garrison duties and take on a young officer named Arthur Wellesley.
I think I might have heard of him, but that's a story for another day.
It is.
Brilliant. Well, Robbie, we're nearly ready to wrap up. Having researched and followed this regiment all the way through this, essentially about a decade, what do you see as their strengths and weaknesses? Did they live up to their pre-war reputation as, you know, the pattern? And were they as good as people thought they were? Do you think they were seen as an elite unit? What's your assessment of their performance during this era?
That's a good question. I think overall they live up to the hype. But it's not as cut and dried as saying they were the best or even they were nearly the best. There's more to it than that. So traditionally, the best troops in this period, as popularly seen, would have been the Brigade of Guards. So the Royal Guards, the Foot Guards, the 1st, 2nd and 3rd Regiment of Foot that become the Grenadier Guards, the Coldstream Guards and the Scots Guards. So they are viewed as being sort of like the best regiment. But even they, before the war, are being trained by members of the 33rd in stuff like light infantry tactics, because Cornwallis is developing these concepts and uses the 33rd as kind of like a test vehicle. And then when they learn things, they move on and teach other people. So even the guards are being trained by the 33rd. And there are multiple accounts from the periods that say that the 33rd really are top notch. They are, as you said, the pattern. So the concept of that nickname is they're the unit that is the basis that other units are made off of. You know, they are the standard templates of good training and discipline. And that carries over into the war because, as I mentioned, they're chosen for special duties that normally a normal line regiment wouldn't necessarily be picked for, like being in the vanguard at Long Island with the grenadiers and the light infantry. They request specifically at different points of the war that they be used as an entire battalion of light infantry. So even the 8 regular hat companies, they've been trained by Cornwallis to act as light infantry. And they say to whichever British commander is in charge at the time, can we do this? You know, can you send us out and we won't mess this up. And they are allowed to do that. They operate that way in 1779. And again, in the South in 1780, they're part of the vanguard. And this isn't sort of just it's not just a title being light infantry. You know, you might think, oh, you just learn to skirmish and then you're light infantry. There's more to it than that. So when the 33rd are operating as light infantry in the South, a couple of other regiments, other line regiments, get a bit jealous. And they say, I think it's the 7th and the 23rd say, well, they're getting to operate as light infantry and head off on patrols and do all this kind of stuff. We should get to do that too. So the commander says, all right, you can try that as well. And they set off on a patrol of about 50 men and they're almost immediately ambushed and almost completely wiped out. So that doesn't happen to the 33rd. And it shows that they were putting into practice the things that they learned and the things that they trained with in the UK. Were they the best? It's difficult to quantify because, you know, there's a lot of battles, there's a lot of regiments. Other regiments are described as being very good. One of the regiment even gets called the Pattern as well later on in the war, the 23rd, which I mentioned. They were seen as kind of like a brother regiment with the 33rd. They were brigaded together in the South and they operated very effectively together. So no, I wouldn't sort of be a fanboy and say the 33rd, best ever regiment. They were just very good. which in itself is an important accolade because there were a lot of effective regiments and the regiment's record in combat speaks for itself, which I think is what you have to ultimately look at if you're trying to decide these sorts of things.
So there is a bit of a myth that the American revolutionaries were these skilled woodsmen, masters of light infantry tactics, and they made these silly Brits, you know, stomping around in their red coats look like idiots, and that they outshot us and outfought us. Is that actually the case? What would you say, having studied this period in such detail?
Yeah, that's kind of the myth-making aspect of it. The concept that the British Army was really hidebound, and you know, it was just led by these aristocrats who didn't appreciate reality and fighting in North America with its wooded terrain, it's kind of all just a myth. It's pretty easy to debunk because the British Army had won a war in North America about a decade prior to the Revolution. So clearly it's not as though this is some alien world to them, and they have no concept of how to deal with this kind of terrain or this type of warfare. As I mentioned previously, the light infantry, the development of light infantry doctrine was extremely important and was considered important by British high command, developing this way of fighting in forest terrain and being able to combat colonial forces that use this kind of warfare. There's also the simple fact that it wasn't just sort of the red-coated British regular soldiers doing the fighting. There were loyalist Americans who obviously knew how to fight in North America, and Native American tribes tended, if they were involved in the conflicts, the vast majority fought on the side of the British. So obviously they're using guerrilla tactics and fighting on the frontier, ambushing continental forces and raiding villages and towns and things like that. So you could probably make a case that there's more guerrilla warfare being pursued by the Crown than there is for the Continentals. I think the big success, the reason the Continental Army won the war, besides stuff like logistics or being supported by France and Spain, things like that, it's not because they were sort of cunning backwoodsmen who were masters of ambushing and things like that, because they didn't really do a huge amount of that. They won it because they became as good at fighting as regular ancient soldiers as the British Army. The Continental Army, by the end of the war, was a complete match in an open linear conflict with the Redcoats. They could go toe-to-toe, and you know, it was basically 50-50 as to who would win. It took a few years to get to that standard, unsurprisingly, because they started from scratch, the colonials. You know, they were staffing their army with ex-British Army officers living in America and things like that. But they got up to the required standard, and they were successful because things like Guildford Courthouse, they could fight the British face-to-face and win sometimes. I mean, the British still win the vast majority of battles in the war, but as anyone that studied military history knows, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to win the conflict. So, yeah, I think the idea that it was cunning guerrilla tactic, frontiersmen fighting like Native Americans, tricking the dumb Brit redcoats, it just wasn't the case. It's not even like I can point to it being, you know, sometimes the case. It almost was never the case. And the success of the war rested on these pitch battles and the wider strategy that people like George Washington adopted to deny the British the ability to win this kind of like definitive pitch battle and stay in the fight long enough to kind of just to win out and break the resolve of the British government at home.
Brilliant. Well, thanks, Robbie. Before we wrap up, though, we've got a picture of your book on screen, The Pattern. Can you just give us a brief overview of where people can get hold of it and what else they might learn in the book that we haven't covered today, so they know what extras they're going to get?
Yes. So it's available, the publisher's website, Hellion, and then it's bunch of sort of the regular bookshops you might imagine online. It's on Amazon, for example, both UK and US and Canada. I think just Google will turn up different sources. I think it's in Waterstones in the UK and possibly Barnes & Noble in the US. If you Google it, then you'll find it and hopefully you'll buy it. In terms of other material, so obviously there's much more weight given to the battles than we had time to today, because literally, the regiment is involved in every battle, every major battle of the war. They somehow even have a company at Saratoga, which is that major defeat I mentioned, which we don't have time to get into today, but that's dealt with as well. There's more stuff about both pre- and post-war, things like their training. These mock battles that I mentioned, there's interesting things to be gleaned from those encounters. There's chapters like The Voyage to America, which I found quite interesting the kind of stress and strain that a transatlantic voyage in the 18th century puts on people is very marked, unsurprisingly, being cooped up in a slightly rotten wooden hold for 6 weeks at least is not fun. So all sorts of stuff like that. I try and deal with it. So the book itself is chronological from pre-war, and then every year of the war is a chapter, and then post-war. But I also try and address wider themes within those chapters. So, for example, there's a section on women with the army, you know, the camp followers who are vital to ensure the army actually continues to function. So I talk about them in relation to the 33rd as well. That sort of stuff. The things that soldiers experienced outside of battle, sort of daily life, things like diet, disease, accommodation. I try and cover all of that. I try to just give as full as possible an overview of life during the revolution with this specific regiment. And hopefully it succeeds in doing that.
Brilliant. And Robbie, what's next for you, matey? Have you got any other work in progress?
I do. I've got some Offspray books coming out. There's one which I've already completed, which is coming out in a couple of months. It's about the Hessians, or technically it's not about the Hessians, because that's another myth that I could spend far too long talking about.
We're going to have you back to talk about that.
I would love to. Yes, the German state troops, who are often called Hessians, that assisted the British. In reality, only about 50% of them were Hessians from the state of Hesse-Cassel. The other 50% were from little other German states that weren't Hesse-Cassel, so like Brunswick, Hanover, stuff like that. So Offspray have done, or I, via Offspray, have done a book about the non-Hessian Hessians, the German troops from all of the little states that weren't Hesse-Cassel. So that's coming out in a few months. And then in a few months more, I'm going to start work on another Offspray title, which is Hessians versus Continentals. So it's a comparative study looking at battles where Hessian troops fought the Continental Army troops specifically, and talking about things like their training tactics, doctrine, how those fights went. So that's what I'm doing history-wise. There's a few other things which I'd like to get stuck into, but none of them are, well, I don't have contracts for them yet, so I probably can't really say anything about them. So that's me at the moment.
So there we have it, guys. Thanks again to Robbie. There are YouTube versions of this interview if you're interested in watching those and maybe seeing some of the maps that we mentioned during the course of the interview. I'm hoping Robbie will be back on the show in the future, maybe to talk about his Hessian books, because he really is good value. In the meantime, please subscribe to my mailing list over at redcoathistory.com/newsletter. When you do so, you'll get a free ebook all about the Battle of Isandlwana. If you're really keen to learn more about history, you can even join my Patreon page, where I post my YouTube videos generally 2 to 3 weeks before they come out on YouTube itself. It's also a place where we get to chit-chat and discuss history, and you can ask me any questions within limits, and we will speak soon. All right, guys, take care.